Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Please be seated. This morning, the court has two matters on its oral submission docket. In the order of their presentation, they are Golden Eagle Archery Incorporated versus Ronald Jackson from Jefferson County and the 9th Appellate District, and Tarrant Regional Water District versus Billy Harden Craig and others from Freestone County and the 10th Appellate District. In each of these matters, the court has allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral argument. The petitioner may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by advising the marshal of the court. We are recording these arguments for the convenience of the court, and you may purchase a tape of any argument for a nominal fee by making application with our clerk. We will take a brief recess in between each argument and obviously complete the arguments before noon. The court is ready to hear argument from petitioner in Golden Eagle versus Jackson.
May it please the court, Ms. Jackie Stroh will present argument for petitioner. Petitioner is reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, my name is Jackie Stroh, and I'm here on behalf of petitioner Golden Eagle Archery, Inc. We are here today to address the numerous legal errors that the Ninth Court of Appeals committed in reviewing Ronald Jackson's great weight point. Specifically, his great weight point went to the jury's failure to award damages for the element of physical impairment other than loss of vision. Among the legal errors that the Ninth Court of Appeals committed, it sanctioned the improper submission of dual physical impairment elements and thereby reversed absent a showing of harm. The Ninth Court reversed the zero damages award despite the fact that there was no evidence of physical impairment other than loss of vision in the record.
What is the legal standard for recovering physical impairment damages?
Your Honor, the definition of physical impairment, in order to make that showing, the plaintiff must prove a distinct, separate, and substantial injury that goes beyond pain and suffering and beyond loss of earnings. And we do not have that in this record here for physical impairment other than loss of vision.
Is temporary impairment enough?
Your Honor, I think temporary impairment would be enough. I mean, I don't know anything in the case law that says that the impairment has to be permanent, but it has to be a physical impairment that results from the injury.
Well, the reason I ask that is if the jury had awarded some amount for physical impairment, would there have been some evidence to support it just by the fact that the plaintiff was in the hospital for a period of time? I mean, there's case law to support that proposition.
First of all, Your Honor, the jury did award money for physical impairment. It awarded money for physical impairment for loss of vision. It simply did not award money for physical impairment other than loss of vision.
Well, and that's what I'm speaking about.
And concerning the claim about hospitalization alone supporting physical impairment damages, there is, in fact, no case law that hospitalization alone would support a recovery for physical impairment damages. Every case that talks about hospitalization in the discussion of physical impairment has evidence of, for example, the plaintiff was able to do X before the injury and is no longer able to do that. For example, in this case, this court's Estrada case, which was decided just last year, the court talked about hospitalization, but it also talked about the fact that the plaintiff was not able, well, did not talk, but referred to the Court of Appeals discussion, that the plaintiff was not able to play basketball, go snow skiing, take long trips in a car, etc. Those are the types of, that's the type of evidence needed in order to recover from physical impairment.
But if temporary impairment is enough, and if I'm hospitalized for 30 days so that my physical activity is restricted and I'm unable, be obviously at a point where I'm unable to function as normal, why isn't that a period of physical impairment that lasted 30 days that is a distinct and separate substantial injury under your definition?
Because, Your Honor, it's not physical impairment. What it equates to is lost time. I mean, why isn't the plaintiff entitled
I am unable to undertake during that period of time the activities that I ordinarily would because of the fact that I am incapacitated in some way.
But first of all, he recovered physical impairment damages for loss of vision, and the hospitalization relates to that.
I'm just talking generally. I'm just talking generally in terms of understanding the legal definition. If I have a period of time where I am unable to to participate in the activities that I normally participate in, then why isn't that a distinct and separate substantial injury within your definition?
Because, Your Honor, I think that the focus on hospitalization alone is erroneous. If you're focusing on a disability that's occurring while you're hospitalized, that would be one thing.
Okay, so that would be enough if there was a disability while you were hospitalized.
Well, there was evidence in the record that said that you were able to do X before the accident, but because of this impairment, not just injury, but because of this impairment, you are not able to do X after the accident. And as
support,
I'm afraid
I'm not understanding the distinction between the two.
Well, Your Honor, I mean, anybody can be injured. I mean, you know, someone can, for example, you can receive a blow to the face, but just because you're injured, that doesn't mean that you are impaired or prevented from doing anything by virtue of...
But where am I recovering? I may be recovering pain and suffering. I may be recovering mental anguish. But where am I actually recovering for the physical incapacity, the injury that I have actually sustained? If I'm not getting it through physical impairment damages.
Well, Your Honor, I am not aware of any case that says that there is a damages element just labeled injury. For example, this court's Huber v. Ryan case dealt with a conflict, an alleged conflict between jury answers. One of the answers was the plaintiff injured? And the jury said yes. And then another question asked, what damages is the plaintiff entitled to recover? And physical impairment was an element. And this court said there's no conflict between the jury's failure to award damages for physical impairment and a finding of injury.
I understand. I'm just trying to understand your legal definition. And so as I understand it, just being incapacitated or actually being injured is not anything that you recover for.
Not that I'm aware of, that the case would support such a recovery.
What threshold does physical impairment require?
Well,
what threshold of inconvenience or loss of something?
Well, Your Honor, there has to be evidence of a loss. I mean, there has to be evidence that there is an impairment, a physical impairment, that prevents you from doing something after the accident that you were able to do before the accident. And we don't have that in this case for other than loss of vision. And I would also point out to the court, this is our second argument. Our first argument concerns the fact that the trial court improperly split the physical impairment element into dual elements, which goes against this court's broad preference for broad form submission, and in fact, Rule 277's mandate for broad form submission, and therefore Ronald Jackson cannot show harm.
But isn't that what a trial court ought to do? If it's clear that there's physical impairment for loss of vision, and you're not contesting that.
We haven't challenged the jury's award of damages.
But it's not clear but the trial judge is not clear if there's any other physical impairment. Isn't this precisely what a good trial judge should do in order to prevent a retrial?
Well, how does that compensate the plaintiff for something where a broad physical impairment element would not? I mean, a physical impairment element...
If only vision is required, the trial judge isn't sure, but he's sure that there's vision and not sure if there's any other, then submitting him one blank could lead to error if he allows there to be argument over something that you later convinced the appellate court was improper.
Your Honor, I am certain that this court does not want to go down that road. If you are going to split damage elements into physical impairment for loss of vision, physical impairment for other loss of vision, what's to stop a plaintiff or any party from splitting other subjective damages elements into sub-elements?
The trial judge. That's what's to stop.
Well, Your Honor, the problem is that you cannot justify it in this circumstance and not justify it in others. I mean, for example, beyond damages, what if you look at the liability question? Why can't a defendant come forward now and say that we want separate submissions of sub-acts of negligence? Failure to keep a proper lookout, failure to timely stop, etc. How is that any different from submitting or splitting distinct damages elements into further sub-elements? The plaintiff is not recovering for any additional injury that he would not be able to recover from a simple physical impairment broad form element.
Let me ask you a question. It seems to me that you come out of a bodily injury and you're out of the hospital, but for 6 months the doctor restricts your activities. for the recovery period. You're not supposed to use your arm, or you're not supposed to lift objects more than 20 pounds or something. It seems to me that that would, under any description, that would be physical impairment. If that were the case, how would you distinguish that from the recuperation period of being in the hospital? So I'm not supposed to, I guess I'm supposed to recover in the hospital for a week, and then I'm up, and then I'm just fine. You say, well, just hospitalization shouldn't count for physical impairment, but there might be something else. How do you distinguish between 6 months where I'm out of the hospital and just not permitted to use my arm until it fully heals, and 1 week in the hospital to allow recuperation before my physical body improves?
Your Honor, this is the distinction I would make on that point. If a plaintiff is restricted for 6 months or however long after he's discharged from the hospital, or even if there's no hospitalization, if after he sustains an injury from an accident and he is prevented by virtue of those injuries that he sustained in the accident from doing something that he was able to do before the accident. For example, he injures his foot in a way that he's not able to walk. I mean, that would be something that would be compensated by virtue of the physical impairment element. Where it's simply hospitalization and you're recovering from the injury itself or from a surgery or something like that. I mean, the problem there is you are simply recuperating from, for example, the effects of the surgery. There's nothing in the injury itself that is producing a physical disability that's preventing you from doing something before the accident, after the accident that you were able to do before. And I would also point out that absent in this record, except as it relates to
you're drawing a line between you get injured and because whatever your medical treatment is and whatever restricted activities you have flow from that injury, and yet you act like it's something different. It's just the hospitalization. But I wouldn't be hospitalized or undergoing the surgery or having my doctor say, I want you to just have bed rest, no activity, if I hadn't been injured. How can you draw the line?
Well, because, Your Honor, I mean, if you want to go, if you want to characterize it in that way, then what's to preclude, for example, finding physical impairment by virtue of being involved in the accident itself? I mean, say there's a car accident and you are injured and you are in the car. I mean, during that time, you're not able to engage in any activities. I mean, I think it has to be something that injures you, that causes a physical impairment, a disability that prevents you from doing something after that you were able to do before. It's not just lost time.
And well, we're not talking about lost time. We're talking about the fact that your activities are restricted, that you are unable to do them for a period of time, and that may be the result of the kind of medical treatment that you're receiving. And that may be some evidence of your physical condition that you are required to have that kind of care where your activity is restricted.
But where is the evidence here that there is something that he was able to do before the accident that he's not able to do now, except as it relates to loss of vision? For example, I'll give the court examples of evidence in the record. He says he liked to go hunting. He liked to play pool, etc., prior to the accident. There is evidence in the record, his testimony, that after the accident, because of the loss of vision, he was no longer as proficient at pool, proficient at hunting, and therefore his activities that he was able to do before the accident are restricted. That is evidence of physical impairment. And we're not disputing that. We haven't challenged the jury's award of damages for that element. There's no similar testimony like that for physical impairment other than loss of vision. And I really don't want this court to get off on a tangent because the jury did award damages for physical impairment. It simply did not award them for this improperly submitted additional physical impairment element for other than loss of vision.
So you did say we don't even need to address the question of whether it has to be temporary or hospitalization is sufficient. We can just go straight to the evidence and say under any standard that might apply, there's evidence to support what the jury did, or on the other end, there's no evidence to support an award of damages.
That's true, Your Honor, and it also relates to our initial point, which is that there is no authority for splitting the damages elements into sub-elements And because Ronald Jackson was not entitled to that submission in the first place, he cannot show harm by virtue of the jury's failure to award him damages for the second physical impairment element. Your Honor, we also have a point relating to the Ninth Court's use of the zero damages rule rather than the standard enunciated in Poole. The court, in its opinion, referenced the zero damages rule and, by virtue of the language in the opinion itself, failed to use the standard in Poole, which would require them to view all the evidence and to detail all the relevant evidence related to
this damages element. What evidence did they fail to detail that should have been mentioned in the opinion that wasn't?
They failed to detail evidence of Ronald Jackson's good recovery. They failed to recognize the fact that he had already received damages for physical impairment for loss of vision.
No, but what evidence, if in conducting the Poole review, they're required to detail all the evidence, and you say that they failed to detail it all, what specific evidence should have been recited in the opinion that was not?
Yes, Your Honor. The fact that he made a good recovery, the fact that he was released to work less than 2 months after the injury at his own request, the fact that he continued to engage in activities after the accident that he did before. In fact, he had been squirrel and deer hunting after the accident and did continue to play softball, do work around the house, etc. Both he and his wife testified to that fact.
Anything else?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. David Holman will present argument for respondent.
May it please the court. Is there objective, undisputed evidence of physical impairment other than loss of vision? On this record, it's pretty obvious that there is.
Well, that's what the brief says, but then it doesn't say what it is.
Well, the Judge Stover said what it was.
He says, this is so obvious we don't need to tell you what it is. But
well, I can tell you I can tell you what it is, and Judge Stover also said
okay,
what it
tell
is.
Us.
It was a broken nose. It required nasal reconstruction. It required a bone graft. It was a ruptured sinus. There were four bones around the orbit of the eye that were fractured. They required resection. It had nothing to do with loss of vision. The eye wasn't operated on at all. There were two operations, two surgeries that were performed just to fix the bones that were messed up around the eye.
Okay, now, ordinarily, I mean, antediluvian, when I was practicing law, that's medical and lost wages and pain and suffering covers that. And these damages came up 20 years ago, I guess, across the nation in a number of different names like hedonic damages. And this captures something else. This is what these injuries keep you from being able to do that's not related to a job. It doesn't take into account any additional medical. That's already all been covered, but it's the loss of being able to do something. And I think everybody's agreed, at least at the Supreme Court level, that the loss of vision caused those kind of damages to your client. Right?
You're all agreed to that.
We're up to this point. Now, what this other stuff sounds terrible, and I don't want it myself, but what loss is it caused that's not loss of time at work, medical bills, or pain and suffering?
This court faced this very question last year in the Estrada case. Very question. Somebody said, well, all you've got to show is this injury. Where's the impairment? And the court said, impairment is when your activities are restricted. And we've got more than just the injury. Here we have hospitalization. And here we have fractures. And here we have surgeries. This court detailed that evidence and said that the court properly conducted a factual sufficiency review because it wasn't relying just upon the injury. If there had been only evidence of an injury, no hospitalization, no surgeries, no fractures.
So your position, though, is that if you're hurt in a car wreck and you go into the hospital and a bone is broken or something and then immediately operated on and there's a full recovery, there would still be impairment.
Correct. And the reason is because you're restricted at least during the time that you're in the hospital.
Well, but you would say almost as a matter of law, you wouldn't leave it up to the jury to decide. Because it sounds like you're saying because hospitalization and time that he was recuperating is impairment per se, the jury has to award something, regardless of whether there's testimony of any specific activity that was curtailed.
I don't think so. And the reason that I don't think so is you're referring to the zero damages rule. The zero damages rule would award, anytime there's an objective injury at all, the zero damages rule would require reversal. That's not what Judge Stover did. Judge Stover looked at the undisputed evidence. And if, for example, you're in the hospital but it's because of subjective injuries, I don't think that that would qualify in this situation, and the courts don't feel that this would qualify in that situation. It's only when you have undisputed, objective evidence of injury
that
results in hospitalization, surgeries, and fractures.
All right, let me parse my question down and exclude subjective injury. I mean, you're saying as long as there's any physical injury, a jury has to award something.
No.
What evidence is there in this case of some specific activity that this plaintiff was precluded from engaging in as a result of physical injury?
Well, because the nose was pushed over and the sinus was ruptured, he had trouble breathing. He talks about that in the record.
Is there any evidence of what that precluded him from doing?
Breathing. When he was discharged on October 14th from the hospital, he was in the hospital for some 9 days. When he was discharged, there was a limitation, a restriction put on his activities in the nursing discharge summary in Exhibit 27. And he was restricted from doing any lifting, any straining, any bending. When he was discharged from the hospital on November 14th, in the nursing discharge summary, it says that he was restricted from doing any lifting of heavy objects, from any straining, from lifting and bending. These are physical restrictions.
I guess where I'm having trouble is you would take it away from the jury to decide, well, this really is de minimis other than loss of vision and the other pain and suffering that we've awarded, and we're going to put it into pain and suffering rather than impairment. You would have them have to put a dollar figure there just from the fact of the injury.
I think there's a lot of levels you have to get to before you're requiring a jury to put a dollar figure there. It has to be objective. It has to be more than de minimis. It has to be significant, I would believe. And there has to be objective, undisputed evidence of the injury. It can't be anything that you would challenge the person's credibility on. For example, if the person said, well, geez, I haven't been able to get up, okay? And they attacked him on his credibility on that issue, that wouldn't be enough. It would have to be something that would be undisputed, independently proved, and not subject to a contest to his credibility.
But to follow up on Justice O'Neill's question, that would mean any time you're in a cast or on crutches, the jury must find some physical impairment.
The jury has discretion to award damages. The jury does not have the discretion to ignore the undisputed evidence and award no damages.
That's my question. Let's say in every case where you've got a cast or you've been on crutches for a period of time, must the jury put a dollar figure in that blank?
Well, if that's what the evidence is, I believe they must.
The evidence is...
Yeah, otherwise it would be against the greater weight of the evidence and manifestly unjust for them not to award some damages for physical impairment if, as in this case, there's uncontested liability. We have liability. The question is, what are the damages? If the jury has no discretion to say there are no damages when, in fact, there is undisputed evidence of some damages, and that's the problem in this case. Now
again to follow up on Justice O'Neill's question, what if the jury puts it in pain and suffering or mental anguish or lost earning capacity? I mean, you're saying that they have to put a dollar amount in yet another blank, or it gets another trial.
Well, I think so, because the jury has to follow the instructions that they're given by the judge. The jury doesn't have the jury cannot make up what the law is.
The jury's been told not to give, they were told in this charge not to give a double award.
That's right.
And so when they got to this blank, couldn't they say, we're not smart enough to separate mental anguish out from this, so we've already given it there?
Well, they could say that, but they'd be wrong, because the court looks at what the damage elements are. And in the damage elements, it says physical impairment for loss of vision, physical impairment for other than loss of vision. If they award some for physical impairment for loss of vision, which they did in this case, and it's unchallenged, the question becomes, is there evidence of impairment other than loss of vision?
Let me ask a question. How do you distinguish between, I understand you're talking about a broken bone and some sinus issues, but if I have this event that, you know, fractures the orbit around my eye, and I go to the hospital and I'm there and I have undisputed loss of vision because of this, and I'm being treated in the hospital, and in addition I'm also being treated for repairing my nose and my cheekbones and that sort of thing, the jury, I mean, how do I determine that the 5 days that I'm in the hospital, or the 3 days I'm in the hospital, or the 24 hours I'm in the hospital is, you know, the first hour is because of the vision and the last 3 hours are because of the broken nose? Or I mean, how do we parse through? How would the jury parse through that the impairment, if, as you say, merely restricting me to the hospital is a physical impairment, how does the jury parse through that the reason you went to the hospital was because of this hitch in the face, and I can't parse through that the scar on this one was 1 hour and the scar over here was 2 hours and my eye was the third hour? How do you expect them to do
that? I think the answer to that question is that they're discrete damage elements. And the reason I say that is because loss of a sense, which is what loss of vision is quite different from a physical loss.
But you're arguing that the impairment is the result of mere restriction in the hospital. You're arguing that the mere fact that I am here in the hospital is the impairment that I'm entitled to be compensated for. And you're trying to say, but I'm going to parse that stay in the hospital between discrete types of injuries I'm complaining about.
Well, I think if you look at the evidence, as Judge Sober did, you'll see that the reason he was in the hospital that length of time was not because of loss of vision. He could see. His eye wasn't operating. The reason he had surgeries was not because of loss of vision. It was because of the facial fractures that had to be repaired.
Well, then what impairment for, why did you ask the jury for impairment for loss of vision?
Well, he had impairment for loss of vision. That's why I say that they're discrete injuries. They're different. Loss of vision, he had blurred vision. He had problems with depth perception. He had problems with playing pool, as Mr. Stroh said. He had problems with hunting. He doesn't have depth perception. One of the things that they said in the his wife's testified to was that he has to buy new shoes all the time because he can't look down, and so he's always bumping his shoe and scuffing his shoe. Those are discrete injuries limited to loss of vision. On the other hand, the reason for the surgeries, the reason for the impairment, just as in Estrada, hospitalization, fractures, and surgery, was caused because of the facial fractures.
And all that's over. Is there any evidence of permanent?
No, there is not.
So we're just talking about that period of time.
Correct. And there's good case law to the effect, to answer Justice O'Neill's question, about whether temporary injuries can be enough for physical impairment, or temporary situations.
The jury, but the impairment due to vision is permanent.
Correct.
And the jury found $2,500 for that.
Correct.
And the disfigurement is permanent, or appears to be permanent.
Correct.
Sacked under his eye. And the jury found $1,500 for that. And now we're talking about temporary impairment. How much do you think we're talking about? A few hundred dollars?
I don't think it's a few hundred dollars.
It surely wouldn't be more than the permanent impairment.
Well, the damages for permanent impairment have been challenged. I think it's kind of ridiculous for the jury to award only $2,500 for permanent loss of vision. But I wasn't on the jury. I don't know what their thinking was. But certainly the impairment here, we're not talking about, as Justice Gonzalez said in his article, we're not talking about a scar on the forehead. We're talking about fractures of four of the bones around your face, a break in the nose, a ruptured sinus, a bone graft. These are significant damages. And it's not, although the evidence, and let me get to one issue. Stroh said that Justice Stover, Judge Stover's opinion is wrong because he didn't detail all the evidence. Justice Hankinson said, what evidence? She said, well, evidence that he healed up. Now, surprisingly enough, this very issue was addressed by the Court of Appeals in the Estrada case. In that case, the evidence, they said, well, he could snow ski after the accident. He could play basketball games after the accident. And the court said, wait a minute. What we're talking about is hospitalization, fractures, and surgery. Whether he could snow ski at some later time, whether he could play basketball at some later time, is not relevant to his past physical impairment. And why is that important? Why is that important that the court said it's not relevant? Because if you look in Poole, you look way back to Poole, 1986, court says that the proper factual sufficiency review is that the court must detail the relevant evidence, issue evidence relevant to the issue. And that's why it's so important that you that the physical impairment doesn't have to be permanent. There's a case cited, the Rosenboom case. And in that case, the woman was in a wheelchair when they dropped her. And she was in the hospital for a week. There was evidence, and they said it should have been considered, that she was okay after that. She was still impaired for that week that she was in the hospital, and the court upheld physical impairment damages for that. Intuitively, we know that this is correct. For example, if somebody had a fractured spine, and they were laid up for 5 years, and then they had a miraculous recovery after 5 years, would we say then that they weren't impaired during those 5 years because they had recovered? The fact that he recovered is not relevant to the past physical impairment he suffered, and therefore didn't need to be included in the detail of the relevant evidence. Now, was there any conflicting evidence? And I concur. If there was any conflicting evidence, then we wouldn't be here. Judge Stover would have been incorrect in his factual sufficiency review if there was any conflicting evidence. I've read the record. There is no conflicting evidence. In fact,
there can't be, because you say it's enough that he went to the hospital. He went to the hospital.
Well,
and he had surgery. There's no question about that. So how could there be any conflicting evidence?
There was no cross-examination here. There were no medical witnesses put on by the defendant. There was nothing to challenge the fact that this occurred.
Yeah, but you can't say you didn't really have a surgery, did you? I mean, when the medical records are sitting there saying that he did have surgery.
Right. Or somebody could have challenged whether he couldn't breathe, you know, as he said he couldn't breathe.
But that wouldn't matter, would it? I mean, as long as it was an objective problem, he went to the hospital and he had surgery, that's enough.
I think it would matter.
Okay.
And as I said to Justice O'Neill, I think just the fact that he had an objective injury and went to the hospital may not be enough. What we're talking about is the court weighing the evidence. The Court of Appeals weighing the evidence. This court, of course, doesn't have the jurisdiction to re-weigh the evidence, but we're talking about the Court of Appeals weighing the evidence and determining that the jury finding of zero damages is so against the great weight and preponderance of the evidence as to be manifestly unjust. At some point, if it's de minimis, as Justice Gonzalez said, it's not manifestly unjust.
That's what worries me, because the jury found $2,500 for a lingering vision impairment, $1,600 for a lingering physical deformity, and zero for a temporary physical impairment. It looks like, in their thinking, it was close to de minimis.
With all due respect, the jury must have been wrong.
But you think it was wrong on the other two issues, too.
Well, I mean, that's been challenged in the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals didn't address that, the inadequacy of damages, because the court resolved it based on issue four.
Mr. Hammond, how would you state the standard to be applied in determining whether physical impairment damages should be awarded?
The legal standard, just as it was stated here. If there is independently proven evidence, subjective and doesn't rely on the credibility, that shows a restriction of the activities through hospitalization, surgeries, I think that establishes that a jury's finding of zero damages in that situation is so against the great weight and preponderance of the evidence as to be manifestly unjust.
Let me ask you, I know you didn't try the case, but why was this issue split up? Theoretically, I suppose they could have broken it down into many different lines, impairment for loss of vision, impairment for problems with smell, perhaps, because of the nose injury, impairment. Why not five points, and why did this come up?
The only thing that I can guess, because I wasn't there at trial, I have talked to the trial lawyers and asked them that very question, and the reason they said was because they had evidence of what the impairment was for loss of vision. But that was discrete and separate from the evidence for impairment for other than loss of vision. And so they wanted to separate it because they were discrete elements of damages.
That's true, though, in any case, I would imagine, that they're discrete elements of damages.
I don't think so. And the reason I don't think so is because I think that loss of a sense, as I said before, is as different from physical loss as mental anguish is. I mean, I think that they're discrete elements of damages, and that's why I was submitted. Another reason it was submitted, of course, was because if you don't have separate damage lines, then you're unable to conduct a meaningful appellate review of those damages. You have a situation, and the petitioner admits this, that broad issue submission is not always preferable, particularly in light of Castillo. And I know that the court has this issue before it now about whether the Crown Life versus Castillo per se error rule applies to multiple damage issues submitted. But I think it's the prudent thing to do for the court to submit, if there's evidence to support it, to submit separate damage lines, if they're discrete elements of damages. It's not to say that they should submit mental anguish and here and mental anguish there and mental anguish there, because mental anguish is all the same kind of, it's the same quality of evidence.
But why wouldn't you have mental anguish attributable to loss of vision and mental anguish attributable to...
Because I think qualitatively, mental anguish, mental anguish is the same. Qualitatively, however, the loss of a sense and a physical loss is quite different.
Any other questions?
Real quickly, what have other jurisdictions resolved this question?
Other jurisdictions have the same sort of resolution that we have. They have the against the greater weight challenge, and they, for physical impairment, which has required hospitalization and surgeries, courts have held that it's against the great weight of the evidence and manifestly unjust and needs to be reversed.
So you have to award something for impairment in every case where there's been hospitalization. That's what other jurisdictions have said.
Well, I think there's a threshold, but that threshold has to be determined by the Court of Appeals judge that has the jurisdiction to determine.
I was just asking what other jurisdictions have said.
Yes. I can't give you any specific sites to other jurisdictions.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Ms. Stroh, would you respond to Mr. Holman's point that the evidence that you say should be detailed is not relevant to the damage element because it occurs after his recovery?
Your Honor, I think the evidence is relevant because it shows the nature of the injury and whether it was likely an injury likely to produce physical impairment for other than loss of vision. Whether it comes before or after,
now,
it's still relevant to that point.
I think his point is that there was a finite period of past impairment that this element went to, and that the Court of Appeals detailed the elements relevant to that time period, and that what you're talking about is outside that time period. Is there any evidence, if you respond to his argument, is there any evidence within the period of physical impairment that he's claiming that was not detailed by the Court of Appeals?
Well, the evidence that I gave you during my argument is the evidence that I feel is relevant
in
support of the jury's award.
Okay.
But I would also point out that the evidence that's recited by the Ninth Court of Appeals and that was detailed by Mr. Holman here today is also not relevant to the element of physical impairment other than loss of vision. For example, he talks about a broken nose. If you look at the record, in fact, I think it demonstrates that Mr. Jackson did not receive a broken nose from this incident, but in fact, during his surgery in Houston, the doctors re-broke his nose from an earlier incident, predating this accident, to graft bone to repair the eye. It was not that he sustained a broken nose as a result of this accident.
His being in the hospital for surgery on broken bones around the eye socket in your face enough to prove physical impairment?
Your Honor, first of all, I would answer that question in the unique circumstances of this case where there is already an element for physical impairment for loss of vision. And I would disagree with what Mr. Holman said, that the surgery was not related to his vision. In fact, after his surgery in Houston, he recovered 100% from double vision that he had sustained and suffered during the interim from the time of his accident until his surgery.
So the answer is it's enough, but it's already covered in the vision part?
Well, I'm not conceding that it's enough, but if it is enough, it's already covered in the other physical impairment element.
Well, I'm asking if it's enough, and I'm just trying to get your answer to that.
Sure, Your Honor. To the extent that Mr. Holman is talking about hospitalization alone and to the lost time reference that I made earlier, I mean, I don't see that that's any evidence of physical impairment, like just the objective injury. I mean, it's no different than if someone held me down in a chair. I mean, I'm not physically impaired from doing anything. I'm restricted from doing something, but I'm not impaired.
Well, where do you draw the line? Because you've already said it doesn't have to be permanent.
That's right.
So if it's only temporary, then why isn't a day of not being able to do what you'd like to do sufficient to get some damages?
I'm not disputing a time period, temporary versus permanent, a day versus a year.
So it could be a day.
It could be a day. Okay. My problem is relying on objective evidence of injury alone, hospitalization alone, without showing how that results in any sort of physical impairment that prevents you from doing something, physical disability that prevents you from doing something after the accident that you were able to do before. I think Justice Hankinson's question gets closest to the mark about, for example, surgery and you're recuperating, but I think in this case it's already covered by the other element, and I would still argue that there is a line to be drawn.
Does that mean that the plaintiff should testify that while I was in the hospital I was unable to play golf, or I was unable to take care of myself and hospital staff had to take care of me? I mean, would they have to actually then just explain their hospitalization and what it was like being in the hospital, and then would that get there?
I would argue that
I'm just trying to understand what.
Sure.
In following up with what Justice Heck was talking about, how do we deal with this hospitalization issue?
I guess I would use the example of, say you have a plaintiff who, before the accident, does nothing. He sits around and watches TV all day. And then he's injured and he's in the hospital. What does he do in the hospital but sit around and watch TV all day? I mean, there's no evidence
All right, so if the plaintiff comes in and talks about what the hospitalization was like and the fact that they were in intensive care, hooked up to tubes for 3 weeks and were unconscious and didn't really know. I mean, is that what they have to do, talk about what their hospitalization was like,
so that we know
whether they were truly restricted or not?
My point here, Your Honor, is that it has to go beyond a simple restriction of your activity by virtue of being in the hospital itself.
I know, but that's why I'm asking you. Would it be enough for the plaintiff to come in and testify about the specifics of their hospitalization and how they were restricted during that time period? Would then that be enough evidence?
Things that an injury physically prohibited them from doing, yes, I think that would be enough.
I've got a question. Coming from a different point of view, you're in an accident and it breaks your back, and so you have to be in bed, immobile, for 6 months. It would seem to me that is a compensable injury. Would we ordinarily cover that through pain and suffering? Would that be a pain and suffering compensability, or would that be a physical impairment injury?
Your Honor, I actually think that could be both. I mean, you could recover pain and suffering for the physical pain that you experienced as a result of your injury. For example, if you have back pain, but then you could also recover physical impairment because you were prohibited from doing X, Y, and Z after the accident that you were able to do before.
But if it was temporary, simply a part of the recuperative process, you would think it'd be appropriate in argument and evidence to the jury that this would be one of the factors they would consider in the pain and the suffering element although you might be able to submit it under a physical impairment.
Except I think your example is different from simply the recuperative process. I mean, if you have a severe back injury, you may very well be unable to engage in activities due to the injury itself, not just because you are recuperating from surgery or whatever. But the injury to your back itself may prohibit you from engaging in an activity after the accident that you were able to before. There's no evidence of any kind of physical impairment other than loss of vision.
But it would be hard to distinguish between whether the fact that I'm not to leave the bed for 6 months is a direct result of the injury or a direct result of the recuperation necessary to recover from the injury.
I would agree with that.
All right. That concludes the oral argument in the first clause. The court will now take a brief recess.
All right.